Good morning and welcome to this October 21st, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. What we do is what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who want to write and who do write from those of us who actually publish. It's my pleasure to welcome Ann Beattie this morning. And in the second half, I'm talking to Ron Rash, so stay with us for that. But first, Ann Beattie. Ann has been included in the four O. Henry Award collections, in John Updike's The Best American Short Stories of the Century, and in Jennifer Egan's The Best American Short Stories 2014. In 2000, she received the Penn Malamud Award for Achievement in the Short Story. In 2005, she received the Rea Award for Short Story. She was the Edgar Allan Poe Professor in Literature and Creative Writing at the University of Virginia. She is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Her latest collection is The State We're In, Maine Stories. It's published by Scribner, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Anne, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. So first off, I heard you wrote 18 stories in a summer and discarded three of them and then created this collection of 15. 18 stories in a summer is probably more than I've written in my life. Did you feel, sort of find yourself overwhelmingly flooded with things to say, or is that kind of a normal pace of stories for you? Kind of talk about that magical summer.
Well, when you say things to say, you know, I never have the idea in mind. I never know the plot of a story when I begin. I just begin with some very little thing and see what builds from there, or if anything accumulates at all. So, no, I didn't have any, you know, major overarching plan for the book in any way, but I just thought I would give myself permission to sit around and write for myself and see what came of it.
Yeah. There's some wonderful women in here and kind of an exploration of women across time, you know, young women on kind of the brink of adolescence and older women looking back. And I was wondering how you have changed thinking as a writer over the decades yourself, and whether you're areas of concern across time have remained consistent, or if your areas have changed that you think about.
Well, at the risk of sounding terribly boring, I'll go right ahead and be terribly boring and say that really I think the structure of a story becomes even more intriguing to me now. But since I have no control really over a rough draft, anything I do to shape the story, to edit and work with the story after the fact, is kind of a secondary matter, but a very important matter.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, a person changes from decade to decade. I mean, I can't deny that. And I would certainly hope that in ways that aren't easily paraphrasable, I have changed a lot over the years from when I first began writing stories.
Yeah, I'm wondering if when you began writing as a young woman, if it must have been harder to access the older woman's perspective, and now you've got the lovely luxury of memory and looking back and perspective on being a younger woman, and that, you know, breadth of experience gives you great stuff, right?
Right. Yes. We got to get something out of this.
Right? What the heck have we learned? It's funny, you had talked at one point about sort of an absence of a dark childhood, and I always wonder if that's an impediment for a writer. You know, so many writers seem to rely on, you know, the dark experiences of their growing up, and I don't know, it sounds like you had a pretty good childhood, yeah?
Oh, I'm an only child, and my parents certainly did their absolute best. They certainly took it seriously, and like everyone else, as I get older, I do begin to see some of the concessions they had to make and some of the adjustments that were required for them also. But my parents did not have happy childhoods, far from it. And they actually met when they were 13.
Wow.
And my father was in World War II, but they married when he came home on leave at some point. And I think my mother was 23 or 24 when she married. And then she was 26 just shortly after giving birth to me. So, you know, that wasn't particularly old for those days. Now it's particularly young for these days.
Right.
Pretty amazing. But, you know, I was very aware as a child, because I think that's true of only children. You don't have any brothers and sisters to bounce things off of. You don't have anybody who's really like you. You just have people who are somewhat like you and who, let's hope, care about you, and that's your parents. But it's a weird kind of introduction to life in this world to be a loner for so long.
Yeah. Did you rely on writing back then to sort of make sense of the world when you didn't have other people to bounce things off of?
I didn't really rely on my own writing, of course. I mean, it's not like I was precocious and I was always scribbling little stories or telling little anecdotes or something like that. But I was always a big reader, and both of my parents read to me. I begged my father to keep just reading the comics to me and not send me to kindergarten, and I would still be begging that to this day if I could go back in time.
Did I read, I've read so many interviews lately, but did I read something about him being very interested in reflexology or something like that?
Well, he was interested in anything that, to his conservative way of thinking, seemed very radical. I mean, that's kind of the pathos of my father and his reading list. But, yes, he was interested in foot reflexology, how to sell your house without a real estate agent, and, you know, traits of his astrological sign.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what comes out of these things,
right? Right.
And I love... I love all of the homage to Maine. Maine is not a state that I've spent much time in, and so it's kind of fun for outsiders to take a peek inside. I'm sure Mainers themselves have very strong opinions about their landscape and where they live. And you had said, though you've lived there a really long time, it's sort of a puzzling place to you. And I thought that was interesting, to try and keep getting at a place by... A, mm-hmm. by inhabiting it, and B, by writing about it.
Well, that's certainly true, and I think that almost inevitably happens with writers. I mean, some of us are living where we're living totally under duress, I guess, but even then, you know, you often try to put a positive spin on things, but places can suit you more or less, and I have to admit that it works for me as a writer, but Maine doesn't really suit me all that well. I mean, I'm the last person you would call to climb a mountain on Saturday, and, you know, my gardening is done by somebody else. I mean, let's be honest. I enjoy looking at it from my back porch, but I'm not out there digging in the dirt anymore.
Do you still think of yourself as a New Yorker?
No, I certainly don't think of myself as a New Yorker. Even when I lived there, which was really only within the city from 1980 to 1984, even then it seemed great fun, but it seemed temporary. It seemed like a party that was going to end with sunrise.
Yeah, yeah. But it was at such a great time of your, I guess, you know, being young in New York is a great time of life. And I guess
it was wonderful. You know, and I lived there for 4 years, and I was writing a lot in those years. I was quite prolific with short stories in particular, and that was how I supported myself. And I had a few writer friends, but New York wasn't as popular a destination then as, say, Brooklyn in particular is now. So it wasn't as though I had loads of other writers all around me all the time. I was really kind of a loner in New York also, and my best friends at that point were not writers.
Interesting, interesting. My guest this morning is Ann Beatty. The book, most recent collection, is The State We're In, Maine Stories, a collection of not interlinked, a little bit interlinked short stories. There's a character who pops up now and then. You'd said that you were very kind of cautious of not making them too interlinked. You didn't want characters to just, you know, walk in off stage and step on each other sort of gratuitously. And for all the popularity of interlinked short stories, I thought that was pretty good advice, that it becomes very contrived at some level.
Yeah, and again, you know, there's the story as it first emerges in rough draft, and then there's what you do when you fiddle with it. And I really had to sometimes refrain from putting in just a few more little grace notes of having people overlap. And I really tried, essentially, to keep the Jocelyn sections, which appear at the beginning, middle, and roughly middle and end of the book, I tried to keep those in their own world, like in their own capsule, to suggest that these other things were going on in the community around Jocelyn, but she's, whatever she is, 16 or 17 years old, and these things don't really directly touch on her life. But I think people's lives as they're lived around us do, of course, very much comment on our life regardless of our age.
Right, right. Her story started out as one big chunk of a story that you then broke up. Is that what I read?
That's true. I think I had about 85 pages in manuscript And it was just unwieldy because some of the stories in the book print to, of course, less than the typed pages. But, you know, in typed pages, they were 5 or 6 pages. In the book, there may be 3 or 4, something like that.
Yeah.
But so it was very unwieldy. And I, when my husband got back from his European vacation with his brother, which was another reason I had a lot of writing time, I gave him the manuscript, and he read happily until he got to the boulder that was Jocelyn. And he said, no, you can't do this. You know, you can't have everything else have a totally different kind of tone and resonance and form and then drop this on the reader's head at the end. And I was horrified to hear that, but it really was one of those cases where I went to sleep fighting mad and with myself and woke up the next morning and I thought, oh, I see what to do with that. I see how to spread it out.
What a wonderful thing to have a great reader in your husband. He's
like all too good a reader. He's a painter, and, you know, it's very interesting because so often people assume we have great things in common, and just because we're working in such different mediums, and paint is paint and words are words, we really don't have something in common in that way. We really don't. But, of course, both of us are drawn to things that are visual, and my husband's paintings happen to be narrative, so he's showing people doing things, you know. And at that level, I think we're very temperamentally similar.
Yeah, and you're a very visual writer. I mean, everything is very, I don't know.
I don't know how else to make things real.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've read a lot of non-visual writers. You can really tell. This is, you know, you can really see these people and get into their space. Speaking of Jocelyn, right. I loved her aunt. Her aunt is, I think I could identify a little too well with the aunt, which is not a great thing.
Well, you know, as the writer, when you're writing about somebody who's a teenager, certainly as a woman, you've not forgotten being a teenager and being female, and you're still female, and you're much older, so how can you not, even if you're not exactly like that aunt, how can you not know that other people that age around you are reacting that way? So you get to play out all parts. You know, it's like, putting on a play, and you get to star in every role,
right.
A very childish notion, ultimately.
When you have sort of difficult or, I mean, I'm not going to call her a despicable character because I had kind of a fondness for her. But when you have difficult characters, is it how do you sort of inject your own empathy into them to make them fully realized and you know, good, compelling people? Were there characters in here who gave you more difficulty and were more difficult for you to access in that way?
You know, probably I would have given up on them even in rough draft, and probably there were a few false starts. So when we say 18 stories, you know, that is technically true, but there might have been another 6 or 7 or 8 false starts that I abandoned after the first paragraph or something like that. So, yeah, you know, some people I think I know, and I'm always very happy as characters if they surprise me when I'm writing. In fact, I don't trust them if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is what you're exploring something when you're writing, and you're raising questions, and you're dealing with mysteries on some level. Of course, you can't go around in daily life thinking through the substrata of everyone you meet psychologically. You would never get anything done whatsoever. But you almost sometimes, as a writer, have to fight against that because you do have time and quiet and a character you're making up, so you can therefore analyze that character you've made up after the fact, too. But I don't think that's really what writing is. It's more at least having the pose of capturing something with a quick glance.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking about short stories.
Right, right.
Yeah.
When you say that you abandon, I've heard you abandon sort of 30% or 40% of the stories, and some of them even after a first paragraph, what are there clues that you look for that you say, this just doesn't have legs, this isn't going to make it? Are there kind of death knells to know when to give up?
I suppose so, but I really couldn't point to them very exactly. I mean, I probably could. You know, if I had an abandoned first paragraph, I could tell you why it didn't interest me, but I realize at the same time that if I were to show you a first paragraph and pretend that it was going to stay in the story, I could also speak about the attributes of it. So it's really something that isn't, you know, an intellectual judgment that's verifiable. It's more how I feel physically when I've written that paragraph. It's an almost visceral feeling, like, is it bouncing back? Is it giving me anything back? And if it's just a projection of my own words, I might as well go talk to a friend on the telephone.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Ann Beattie. The book is The State We're In. Talking about rewriting, you know, so much of your story, so much of great fiction in general is, to me, the work of the subconscious, and that, you know, your subconscious comes up with so much great stuff. So tempering that against the rewrite process, which is very, you know, cerebral and very conscious, are you ever nervous about sort of writing? You know, a lot of writers say, I didn't even see that in my story until a reader said, hey, you know, good job there. And then I was wondering if you went in during the rewrite process, if you ever, you know, are worried about writing the magic out of something or writing the subconscious out of something that, you know, maybe you don't even aren't aware of the the wonderful work of your brain.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, writing the magic out of something, I suppose that's true. But, you know, I mean, to take a sort of different perspective about that, which I'm not always mature enough to take, to be honest with you, you think, well, nobody else will know the magic was there. And if you can make it in some way still that paragraph or that image or, you know, that page or whatever, what you want to make it, nobody else is going to know what might have been there. You're the only one that's going to know what might have been there. And then the question is, should you just push harder or think more deeply, or should you just go with what is, I don't mean to suggest that it's serviceable and dismissible and things like that, but nobody else would know what wasn't there but you.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes mm-hmm. sense. I heard you in conversation with Michael Silverblatt in a video, and you were talking about an Alice Munro short story, Post and Beam, which I love too. And mm-hmm. how many times you'd read that short story and, you know, on your, I don't know which reading, you sort of saw her in conversation with Virginia Woolf. And then you start wondering, is the author, her, I mean, I'm sure Alice Munro is aware, but are authors in general aware of those sorts of things, or does it just seep in there and, you know, they're able to do this because of their breadth and depth of reading and, you know.
Oh, it's a hard question to answer. I mean, I think in most cases, yes. I mean, you do assume that the writer has spent so much time with the material that he or she is quite aware of what they're, you know, in dialogue with. Not always, though. I have a dear friend who's a wonderful poet named Ruth Dannon, who teaches at NYU, and I wasn't there for it, but she recently taught a course on Joyce's The Dead and a story of mine called The Burning House. And she said, you know, the unconscious comparisons were just amazing. And even after the fact, and I wrote The Burning House back in the 80s, I thought, oh, really? I'll have to, I mean, I certainly know The Dead backwards and forwards, but really, my story is in there somewhere. So I wish I had been at that class, but I'd totally take her word for it.
You could have taken a class on yourself, right?
No, thanks. I spend enough time in my own head.
Were there stories, which were the stories in here that gave you, it sounds like the Jocelyn stories gave you a little bit of difficulty, but were there other, you could include that story, stories that gave you sort of a headache and finding your way out of them?
Well, I think the one that I worked hardest on really was, you know, I did after my husband's comment about there just being too many pages and just too much of an avalanche of Jocelyn at the end of the book, which wasn't a pleasant experience for the reader. I did break up that story, and then when I broke it up, I added new parts to it. So it's not what you asked, but the Jocelyn stories themselves that are rather long all gave me a lot of problems because I didn't want to be too overt in them, yet I knew what I was going toward. I didn't know the exact sentence I was going toward, which surprised me, and which I won't say because there is a little surprise in the very last page of the book, mm-hmm. but I did know in essence what I was going toward, and so the third of the stories, which is called The Repurposed Barn, I probably rewrote more than anything else in the book, trying not to give away what I was going to give away until the very end.
Yeah, which raises the question of short story endings, which are very different than novel endings. And I have always wondered if that's what makes short stories difficult for the readership at large, that people seem more comfortable with endings that are very tidy and tied up, and short stories don't do that. So you have always said that you don't know what the endings of short stories are. You don't know where you're going with them. And if you did, that would probably be the death of it. Do you know when you've got there? Do you know the ending when you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you?
But that's where I get in trouble, see, because then I sound very loosey-goosey and theoretical and all kinds of crazy things when I try to talk about the endings. But it really is no different writing fiction from doing other things when you simply have to think about the most usual things in life. I mean, you could cut your grass to be rather low or rather high. What is the perfect length? And you decide. You decide if you're going to risk the sun scorching the grass at a particular length or whatever. But then, of course, you have to mow the grass. It's as simple as that. So it's almost like making a real calibration, except that it's an internal mental calibration about a short story, that you're always judging what's the right depth, what's the right approach if I want that depth, how can I make things look on the surface, and what purpose does that surface really serve?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I still just don't know how to do it. It's very very tricky. I find endings of short stories just, usually they seem overwritten, and the ending was a sort of 3 pages back or something.
Or readers, you're quite right. I mean, readers often complain what they want is an O. Henry story, or they want, you know, something that was written in a very different mode many years before, and those stories are really not being written anymore because I don't think writers are looking at the world the same way or satisfied by writing that kind of a neat story in a world that is in no way neat, if it ever was, but certainly it's more complicated in many ways now. But, you know, I think another thing about it is that because it is a moment perhaps when, at least in first draft, the writer realizes something. I don't want to go so far as to say it's an epiphany, but when the writer suddenly realizes what the subtext has been or what it's accruing as, what it seems to be, then you don't want to let it go too far, because when you've caught on, your smartest reader is going to have caught on as soon as, if not earlier than you. So you have to end.
Right, right. The other tricky thing for me are titles. And I always say the poor short story writer has to come up with 15 titles, whereas the novelist only has to come up with the one.
But the one matters so much.
The one matters so much. So do with the other 15, though. They're pretty, you know, and these are not so obvious. And yet, you know, I mean, that's what a great title for a short story is. It's not so obvious, but it resonates and it brings a different texture to the story than the story can do on its own. Can you talk a little bit about titling?
Well, I really tried in this book to title things rather, what should I say? I mean, I wasn't reaching hard for inventive titles for the individual stories because they were on some level working as a whole, and I didn't want to distract the reader by coming up with, very intriguing titles.
Yeah.
So a story about a dog who's named Yancey in the book, for example, is called Yancey. A story in which someone does silently pray to herself toward the end is called Silent Prayer. I mean, they're not quite all that cryptic in terms of being titles. There's another story in the book called Major Maybe, and that happens to, you know, turn on a joke about a neighborhood dog who is named Maybe by the little girl who names the dog, but the dog has initially been named Major, so it ends up being called Major Maybe. But nobody would know what to make of a story called Major Maybe until they read the story, right? So I guess, you know, there's a little seed of mystery about them sometimes, or the stories pass the stories off as being usual, when as the writer you certainly hope that by the time the reader reaches the end, they're not usual at all.
Right, right. You bring up Silent Prayer, which is a story I enjoyed, and a dialogue for me is very difficult. That story was almost entirely done in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman in the story makes a great point about, you know, everybody wonders what married people talk about, and you can never really know because you can't trust television, you can't trust books. And I was wondering if people come to literature to sort of see, you know, check their relationships against other people's relationships and find out if they're on track. Because as I was reading this, I was like, yeah, I'm not that crazy. So that's good.
I think they do. I mean, yeah. But I think that's a good litmus test in a way. I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, you want to be informed on that level as well as on many other levels when you're reading literature.
Right, right. That story is a great example of dialogue, though. And I know, you know, I keep thinking, well, if I sat in a Starbucks and sort of listened to what people say, maybe that would give you a good ear for dialogue. Of course it does not. That's a terrible way to write. Getting an ear for dialogue. Can you give any advice on that? Knowing when your characters are sounding right. You don't want to be a flight recorder, but you want them to say just the right thing at just the right time, but you don't want it to sound overly rehearsed or stilted.
Yeah, right. But you also want them to say something that will advance your particular story. Whereas, you know, if you and I are talking of an evening and having dinner together or something like that, there is no story, really. I mean, it's a social interaction.
Right.
Come to be a story, but that isn't the way anybody looks at dinner, you know. And I think what you have to think about, too, is getting enough of the subtext, you know, what's below that layer of the story, into the story, which can be done rather sneakily, the same way we talk to children rather sneakily sometimes about Santa Claus and things like that. You know what I mean? So it's that awareness, this double awareness, both how people speak and that you want to seem true enough to that, but also that they have to speak at some remove from merely the way they speak, because they can speak any way they want in the so-called real world, but they can't speak that way in your story. There isn't time.
Right. Right. At some point, you had a great observation about readers coming to writers as sort of oracles because they've, you know, identified the issues of human concern. So we think that they have the answers about them, even though, you know, they've just raised the question. But then readers sort of assume sort of an intimacy with the writer because they feel like they've shared some, you know, experience, human universal experience with them. I thought that was so well observed. I think that's right. I think we do sort of come to good writers as, you know, do you have the answer? Because I'm still sort of the way I approach that silent prayer story. Is this, do you have the answer?
Isn't it also a matter of just knowing that you're not alone, thinking, oh, you know, is it okay to talk about this? I mean, I often read short stories and think, oh, is it okay to talk about this?
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, it makes the world feel a little bit less lonely, for sure. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
We're drawing down on our time, but were there things we should have covered that we didn't? Do you have advice for writers, you know, either short story writers or even novelists, how to get through this very solitary process?
Well, I guess remember what you got into it for, and I don't know what every single person has, you know, been drawn to writing because of, but it is a mystery, and like any mystery, it's not going to merely be solved when it ends one way or another, so there you are. I mean, you're always going to be grappling in uncertain territory, and anything you can do to accommodate yourself to that, I would think, would be beneficial, whether it be setting the alarm to get up at a particular hour or writing down good dialogue every moment you hear it or anything else that I personally have never done in my entire life.
I will, though,
and this is really heartfelt. I'm two-thirds of the way through a collection of related short stories by a wonderful writer I've never met, named Anthony Mara, and it's called Bazaar of Love and Techno, and any writer could learn so greatly from reading this book. I'm completely blown away by it.
Yeah,
sincerely.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is a blown-away book, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a notebook keeper? Do you walk around with notebooks?
Nope. Okay. Certainly not, no. When I'm not writing, I really don't want to be writing.
Which is good advice in itself.
I would be frightened to look at what a notebook of any time period would look like, including the day before.
Anne Beattie, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
That was Anne Beattie. The book is The State We're In, Maine Stories. And we're going to take a very short break. Ron Rash will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads, information on past shows, upcoming shows, and more. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone, on with the show. Ron Rash is the author of the 2009 Penn Faulkner finalist and New York Times bestselling novel Serena, in addition to three other prize-winning novels, One Foot in Eden, Saints at the River, and The World Made Straight. three collections of poems and four collections of stories, among them Burning Bright, which won the 2010 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, and Chemistry and Other Stories, which was a finalist for the 2007 Penn Faulkner Award. Twice the recipient of the O. Henry Prize, he teaches at Western Carolina University. His latest novel is Above the Waterfall, and it is what we are going to talk about this morning. Ron, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome back. I was just saying to you before you came on the air that we had, I know you were on with me for Chemistry, and I'm certain you were on with me for The World Made Straight. So you've either been on once or twice, and we talked about two pieces at once, or...
Yeah.
No matter what, welcome back. Welcome back.
Great.
So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about Above the Waterfall for people who haven't picked it up yet. I'm just going to let you give us an introduction of the novel, sort of what were you... You know, what areas of concern you were thinking about when you wrote it, what was on your mind, and the two people that are sort of the centerpieces of this novel.
Yeah. I feel like this was a novel. One thing I've been noticing the last few years is how seldom we use the word wonder as a noun. And that's kind of struck me that I think that kind of ties into what's happening to us as far as technology. But I wanted to write a novel in which I had a character who had to have wonder in the world to survive, and that certainly is the character named Becky in the novel. She's a park ranger, survived a horrific incident when she was a child, a school shooting, but she's someone who's found a way of connecting to the natural world in a really deep way, and I hope a unique way. She's in a relationship, though, with a man who's a sheriff, who has also had his past troubles, and in some ways he's seeking the worst, almost as a kind of solace for something that he did that almost caused a real catastrophe for his ex-wife.
Right, right. So I had heard that the book was coming out, and you noticed that it just wasn't ready to go. There was something, so it was all told from one point of view, and you realized that Becky's voice needed to be heard, and so you pulled the novel back from your publicist and wrote her section.
I did, yeah. I felt like they were crucial because I wanted to really get to really give a sense of her. I felt like I had to go inside her voice, inside her sensibility, and one of the goals of the novel, and it's up to the reader to decide if it's achieved, but I wanted her, I've always admired Emily Dickinson, not only for her language, but the sense that she sees the world in a way no one else has. And I hope that in some ways Becky's voice might be able to do that same thing, that she looks at the world, particularly the natural world, in a way that maybe no one else quite can. And added to that is her love of Hopkins, and in a sense she's created a kind of language for wonder that she tries to immerse herself in as well.
Very poetic. She's very poetic. Well, you're very poetic, so there you go. So her whole point of view is told in present tense, and his point told in past tense, which I also thought was just a really great way to show their perspective on the world, that she's living in the here and now and he's kind of living in the past, and talk a little bit about those decisions and you know, kind of finding their voices and finding their very different voices.
Right. That was important, that she's always in the present tense, because that's how she has to live her life. It's really a survival mechanism for her, that whenever she does something, does kind of trigger really traumatic memory, she immediately reattaches herself to the world. But it's there's an urgency to it that makes it, I think, even more important, more needed, an immediacy. But Les is a man who's kind of let his life coast by. He's tends to turn backward, but also is a man who is a little bit scared to commit to anything, even Becky. But for me, the novel is about two people who are redeeming themselves in very different ways. I mean, one searching for the light, one searching or entering the darkness and almost wanting to see it as a way of exonerating himself. But he's too honest a man to completely do that. And for me, the novel is in many ways about both these people finding a way to live in the world.
Yeah, yeah. It's very steeped in a town that's suffering from kind of chronic meth condition, and I was wondering how much you had said you'd done a lot of research and talked to deputies and whatnot in the town, but that you have to get to a level of empathy and, you know, really crawling inside people's skin to make the characters come alive, that research isn't enough. But I was wondering if you could first talk a little bit about your research process and then sort of making that emotional leap to empathy that you need to write about it.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine was a deputy sheriff. Unfortunately, he passed away not long before the book even came out, so I never had a chance to really thank him. But he had done a number of participated in a number of meth raids, and so he gave me a certain aspect on it. Obviously, certain technical things I needed to know. But yeah, there's a point where you have to, in a sense, empathize and try to imagine what it would be like, and that's where I think. Just a human reaction. How does one react to see a situation where a child might be in a trailer with these people who have pretty much just destroyed themselves physically and mentally as well with this drug? So, and unfortunately, it's a problem that not only here. I was in Minnesota actually last night doing a reading, and we were talking after my reading. Several questions were asked, making the point that this is a rural phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes underreported because it is.
Yeah. There's a great nonfiction book called Methland.
I have read it, yeah.
Yeah, about that very topic, that it's really ravaging the small towns of America more than any place else. And, it's terrible to watch. And am I giving too much? Well, I don't know if I'm giving too much away about Becky's backstory. How much can we talk about Becky's backstory?
No, I think it comes clear pretty early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Becky had lived through a school shooting when she was a small girl that's haunted her for the remainder. And I was wondering if that, if writing is sort of a way for you to make sense of the nonsensical world yourself and sort of, you know, work through these mysterious problems that are just recurring over and over again in our country.
I suppose in some ways, I see myself more as a witness, that I'm, you know, in the sense that I'm going to present these situations because they're true to our world, and try to do it as faithfully as possible, or try to, you know, at least through empathy. But I thought, yeah, this is unfortunately something that has happened too many times. But with that question, how does one surviving any kind of trauma, but particularly something like this, where she also, I don't think it's given away too much, feels some guilt because she actually spoke and feels like the shooter heard her and that gave away their hiding place. But how does one, if not recover, at least cope with the world? And for me, Becky's triumph in the novel is that she has found a way. And not only for herself, but she teaches children to love the world. And I think all of that is an ongoing process for her to find a method to live.
Yeah. Yeah, you have said in many ways this is your most upbeat book, which I kind of like. And your observation that it's easy for writers, and I think this is true, it's easy for writers to always write about darkness. And if you do that, you're not being true to the whole experience of the world because, you know, there's so much great joy and wonder in the world. And the importance of recognizing that, too, and balancing the light with the dark. I think it's easy to get mired down with the dark and the sensational and sort of not take time out for the wonder. And I love your use of the word wonder there.
Well, that as I say, that was an important goal for me, and I think it's important for writers to acknowledge this. I mean, I think we need to bring the news and not just the bad news of the world. But I think there comes a time in a writer's life, and it's interesting to me when I look at, not that I'm comparing myself, but when I look at what Shakespeare, you know, his last play being The Tempest, I think of Faulkner's last novel, The Reavers, and it's almost like as writers sometimes get later in their lives that perhaps they want to give us something that gives us some hope. Seamus Heaney has a wonderful poem where he talks about being almost 50 before he felt like he truly acknowledged the wonder.
You've come to writing later in life. I think your first book deal was at 50, and then you've been so incredibly prolific since then. And I wonder if that gives you, you know, that life perspective before you sit down to write. I don't know if you've been writing your entire life and just came to publishing at 50, but if that life perspective sort of brings something new to the table and sort of a lightness to the table almost.
Well, I think that is true. I think as a young person, I can remember myself, I mean, you're almost drawn to a certain kind of cynicism, a certain kind of view of the world and the foolishness of it. But with age, it's not that you don't see it or you ignore it, but you also start to, or I feel like, at least in my situation, I've started to just recognize how, you know, that there is beauty and wonder and goodness,
yeah,
and redemption. And I think all of those things are essential, a part of being human. And also, I think the writers I admire most acknowledge both those things and you know, recognize the comedic aspects of life as well as the tragic.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Ron Rash. The book is Above the Waterfall. Poetry is obviously so very important to you, and you've written several collections of poetry, and your writing is so very poetic. First of all, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind taking time out to read the prologue of this book, which is pure poetry. It's so pretty.
No, I'd be glad to. It's a scene of Becky's voice, and she's looking at the black-eyed Susans, a flower in the North Carolina mountains, and it's almost dark, and she loves to go watch till the only thing left is the yellow glow of the blossoming black-eyed Susans. The sunlight tinges the mountains, black leather-winged bodies swing low. First fireflies blink languidly. Beyond this meadow, cicadas rev and slow like sewing machines. All else ready for night except night itself. I watch last light lift off level land. Ground shadows seep and thicken. Circling trees form banks. The meadow itself becomes a pond filling. On its surface, dozens of black-eyed Susans. I sit on ground cooling, soon dew damp. Near me, a moldboard plow long lift. Honeysuckle vines twine green cords, white flowers attached like Christmas lights. I touch a handle slick from wrist shifts and sweaty grips. Memory of my grandfather's hands, calluses round and smooth as worn coins. One morning, I'd watched him cross the field, the still ore rippling soil. In its wake, a caught wave of Scillian shine. But this plow has wearied into sleep. How long lying here? Perhaps a decade since saplings and sawbriar rise amid broom sedge. Above all else, those bold yellow blossoms and full-petaled bloom. What has brought me here? A deer emerges from the woods, nose up, stilt step, then steadying paws. Another hoof lifted. Dark rises around me. The black-eyed Susans float like water lilies. All else disappears, but they hold their yellow glow. Moon mirrors, sun ghosts, dream abeyant. When the night pond fills its banks, I walk the trail back to the state park truck.
That is so beautiful. I read this aloud to myself because it's so pretty. Obviously, I would imagine, I shouldn't say obviously, but I assume that you read your stuff aloud to yourself.
Sometimes. I hear the voice. Once I lock into the voice, I hear it without even having to say it aloud, usually. But, but I just thought that voice and that sensibility, I hope, the reader senses that this woman is really seeing the world in a way, not only vividly, but also uniquely.
She has all these wonderful observations also about, how people living now in the age of computers and cell phones only experience the world if they see it on a screen and, they pull out their cell phone and camera to take a picture of things, and it doesn't sort of become real to them unless it appears on a screen. The corollary, which you said, writing on a computer makes the words look prettier than they really are, or more polished than they perhaps are, by putting them on the computer screen, and so resisting technology to get to the real world. I thought that was really well observed. I mean, it's what the computers have brought to us, which is a great many things in the last several decades, but what they've also taken away.
Yeah, and I'm not someone who is, completely against technology or anything. I love the fact that I can move a chapter with just a little couple of taps on a computer screen, but I do worry about that. And I one thing I found really interesting and troubling is how seldom we use wonder, that word, as a noun anymore. I happen to live in a very rural area, mountainous area, so I spend a lot of time outdoors observing the world, and there's something that happens there, and it's not just I think sometimes it's easy, some people can find it easy to dismiss, but I think there's something going on there that we need. That E.O. Wilson has said that human beings are hardwired to connect to nature. I mean, in a sense, that's part of what we are. And when we deny that, I think some things we lose a lot of wonder. And some interesting research being done recently, scientific research. Not this is something I think writers and naturalists have intuited, but some really interesting things as far as how people are more empathetic, less stressed, just merely observing the natural world. Because, in a sense, once again, I think Wilson's right. In many ways, we are programmed and have some kind of need for that. I certainly know that I do in my life. And I think with that, something I find, it seems like to me that our society's terrified of silence. And that worries me, too. I think we need silence. I think we need literature even more now than ever, because it allows that kind of intense contemplation about, very often complex things in a world of Twitter and sound bites.
You'd said that you almost write now more than you speak. And I think what a great way to live your life, that you're thinking the wonderful thing that silence creates in the space in your brain that silence creates, that you're right, is getting sort of snuffed out by all the sound bites. I think that's
great. Yeah, and whenever I'm in I was actually in a airport today, and I really felt like I was moving among the living dead, people staring straight ahead, mumbling to themselves, wired up. Obviously, there are different views on this, but I do find that I think we need the other as well.
Yeah, yeah. You had a great observation about people living amongst the mountains and what living in the shadow of a mountain will do, and the sort of the perspective it gives to make you feel both really small and that sense of wonder of, and I get that. Actually, we live by the ocean, and I kind of have the same thing, that when you stand on the edge of the ocean, it's like you're standing on the edge of the world, and there's no more out there, and it does give you a sense of perspective that I think living in New York or Chicago or something probably wouldn't give you.
Yeah, one of the interesting aspects for me as a writer is, because I very often, landscape even becomes destiny in my work at times, but I've had a lot of readers from all over the world, I mean, different mountainous areas, talk about that sense sometimes of being both trapped and you know, by the mountains, feeling, you know, closed in, but at the same time feeling sometimes almost nestled, almost like a womb, and how both those things can act on us psychologically. So it's been interesting to me to, you know, get letters from, say, someone who lives in the mountains of India or the Alps or the Andes, and kind of, you know, talking about similar sensibilities.
Yeah. There's no nestling that comes with the ocean. It's just...
No, I guess not. Well, but I would think at night, I love listening to waves at night if you have,
yeah, that's
you can hear them.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right.
That would be good. Yeah.
That is good. That is good. You have really resisted the sort of tagline of Southern writer, and you had a great observation about this, that there are regional writers who just write about a, you know, sort of, I forget the phrase that you use, but people that write about a particular place just to bring that place alive versus, you know, writers who are transcending the place, using it as sort of a, you know, metaphor or a great sense of setting, but, you know, moving their writing to the sense of the universal and, you know, transcending the space they're in, which is obviously what you do. But I thought that was sort of a useful distinction for people saying that, you know, well, I'm a Southern writer, or I'm a Northeastern writer, and that you there are certain people who do just write about a particular place for, you know, travel.
Yeah, and that's fine. But, I think, to me, it's the difference between local color and regional. For me, regional writers could be James Joyce or Richard Price writing about a particular place, whether it's New York City or Dublin, or Annie Proulx writing about, you know, Wyoming. But nevertheless, even though those writers are all true to those specific places, ultimately their concerns transcend the place. I'm very proud of that Southern lineage. Faulkner remains my favorite American writer. Flannery O'Connor has been hugely important. But the reason they're important writers is not that they're writing necessarily about the South. It's that they're great writers who, through writing about a particular place, which happens to be the South, they've been able to hit, you know, work that resonates to people in other cultures as well. And so, yeah, that's always tricky. I was in New York 3 weeks ago, though, and it was I found it amusing. A woman heard me speaking, my accent, and said, well, and she knew I was a writer. She said, well, you must be a regional writer. And I thought, well, I'm no more regional than someone writing about New York City.
Right.
I mean, these are all places.
Right. Aren't we all regional writers?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Richard Price is one of my favorite writers, but you know, and he writes almost exclusively about, you know, a certain section of New York City, but he does it marvelously. But I don't see myself as being any less regional than Richard.
There's something about New Yorkers where they do believe that New York, L.A. probably too, they do believe they're the center of the universe and everything else is just, you know, a region outside the center of the universe.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, overseas, you know, that label rarely gets, I'm seen as an American writer. I was in France 3 weeks ago, and, you know, in a sense, I'm viewed there as an American writer. I'm writing about America, which, of course, I am.
Right, right. Yeah, it's all perspective, right?
Yeah.
I do love that story about your agent coming to your New York agent coming to visit you, and a fox running. You can tell that story better than I can. I wasn't there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so funny because as that earlier anecdote I just said implies that sometimes, you know, people hear my accent or they think of the Appalachian Mountains. They've got all the stereotypes. So my agent, a wonderful agent from New York, Marley Russoff, came to visit me in where I live in the North Carolina mountains, and as she was coming up kind of the winding road to my little house, a fox ran out in front of her with one of my neighbor's chickens. And I thought, well, you know, everything I've written has just been, you know, gone. It is in vain, because this is the one thing she's going to remember, you know. Yeah, somebody, you know, a fox stealing a chicken. What could be more stereotypical than that?
It is a great image with her in the, I'm picturing her in her, you know, suit and rental car and everything. It's a great,
yeah,
it's a great,
yeah,
image.
Yeah, that's it. And also the fact that, you know, she thought it was actually a dog, and I had to tell her it was a fox. You know?
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
We're drawing down on our time, but do you have writing advice that you can leave us with?
Well, I think as someone who came to it late, I mean, I did start writing in my late 20s, but I didn't publish in my first real, you know, book, New York book, New York publisher until I was right at 50, is that I think it's like most activities in life. You just have to put in a lot of hours, not give up, not get, you know, you have to accept that rejection. But I think the single most important thing is to read widely. You know, I mean, and certainly I've done that all my life, and I continue to do it. And those things, I think, never change. I mean, every writer I know who's any good is a voracious reader.
Yeah.
We find our own voices out of many others.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good to hear that you've been writing since your late 20s, so people don't come away with the myth, I think, that a lot of people have, that, oh, you know, you just stumbled upon success somehow at the age of 50. And, you know, there's that 10,000 hours thing, I think, is really true, the time it takes.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely, I think for most of us, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but I'm glad it worked the way it's worked for me. I mean, what interest has come in my work has come very slowly, and I think it would be very unsettling to have a lot of success early on. That would, I think, in many ways, or I am very glad that even though for years, you know, no one was interested in what I was doing, I was learning my craft, and when I did finally publish every book I've published, I feel really proud of.
And there have been so many. It's great. It's great. You were really saving up the well there.
Well, it's amazing, you know, if nobody's interested, what you can pile up.
Ron Rash, this was a huge, huge pleasure. Congratulations on all the very, very well-deserved success.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Great to have you back on.
That
was Ron Rash. The book is Above the Waterfall. It is out and available now. It's a really, really special, poetic, great read. That's all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday, and we'll be bringing you more great programming, so stay tuned for that. Until then, Sister Rue is up with some reggae, so keep your dial tuned right here, KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.